This message comes from NPR sponsor, the official Jinx podcast from HBO. The HBO original documentary series, The Jinx, returns for part two on Max as the filmmakers untangle the web of Robert Durst's crimes. Listen to the official Jinx podcast on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.
A warning, this episode contains explicit language, including detailed discussion of body parts and sex acts. In her smart and very funny Netflix comedy special, Get On Your Knees, performer Jacqueline Novak delivers a kind of TED talk on the subject of fellatio. It's also a passionate and thoughtful coming-of-age tale delivered in language that's been finely honed to accomplish its very funny purpose. I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about Jacqueline Novak, Get On Your Knees, on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Joining me today is comedian Guy Branum from the Apple show Platonic. Hello, Guy.
Hello, Glenn. Good to be here. Excited to be back with you guys.
Great to have you. Also with us is the Philadelphia Inquirer's arts and entertainment editor and film critic, Badatri D. Chaudhry. Hey, Badatri.
Hello, hello.
Hello. And rounding out the panel is Margaret H. Willison, faculty with Nuts. Sorry Productions. Hey, Margaret.
Hi, Glenn.
So, Jacqueline Novak, she's brainy, she's witty, she's philosophical, she's hilarious. And over the course of her 90-minute special, Get On Your Knees, she prowls the stage as she unpacks and dissects and satirizes and, by her own very reluctant admission, overthinks the whole notion of oral sex from a heterosexual woman's perspective. Get On Your Knees started out as an off-Broadway show in 2019 and has since toured nationally and internationally. The special also comes with a great comedic pedigree involving a lot of PCHH's favorite people. The off-Broadway run was directed by comedian John Early. Mm-hmm. The Netflix special was directed by Natasha Lyonne. And Mike Birbiglia is an executive producer. Jacqueline Novak, Get On Your Knees, is streaming now on Netflix. Margaret, let me start with you. What'd you think?
Oh, I just enjoyed it so much, Glenn. I appreciate that you referred to it as sort of like a TED Talk because there are ways that it is not like a typical comedy special. Mm-hmm. The shape of it is very different. And I loved that.
Okay.
She ruminates in this really brilliant way on language.
Yeah.
And I could have listened to her do that until the end of time. Mm-hmm.
The first synonym for penetrate is puncture, but you didn't puncture anything here. This is a working passageway, and it's been one for some time. You missed the ribbon-cutting ceremony. We've been operational for a while now.
There are times when it's hewing closer to sort of like the comedy special structure,
right,
where it just isn't quite working as well for me. There's the big sort of like fireworks display joke at the end,
mm-hmm,
that just wasn't as funny for me as a lot of the stuff earlier,
yep,
but it was still extremely funny. And just throughout, I was so engrossed.
Mm-hmm.
This is my first experience with Jacqueline Novak, and I'm so excited to see more work from her and so glad that I got to see this special.
Excellent. Well, okay. Thank you very much. Badatri, what'd you think?
I'm with Margaret there. I mean, I'm with Margaret-ish there. I don't think I found it very quote-unquote big F funny per se. I wasn't like clutching onto the sides of my stomach, blah, blah. It's a weird thing to say with a comedy stand-up special. The prose is fantastic. The writing is fantastic.
Sure.
And this is where, like, you guys go, nerd. Like, I think what she does with the English language, and I know it sounds very trite, but to reconfirm and re-highlight the gendered nature of the way we look at language is fantastic. I'm like, you know, I'm like lit grad nerding on this completely. I really appreciated the writing.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll talk about that.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, Guy, we should note here for listeners that you kind of know Novak. You've said you're professional friends and colleagues the way that all comedians are friends and colleagues.
Yeah.
I gather that your professional appreciation for this particular show is not something you arrived that out of kind of politeness for a friend, right?
Oh, not at all. Like, Jacqueline is somebody I know because you know all stand-up comedians, and I would say that she does end up more in my tide pool than other tide pools. But okay. I also think that this show is reflective of sort of the Brooklyn John Early, let's talk about big concepts in weird ways, School of New York stand-up comedy, and the one-liner, 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 like, comedy seller world of stand-up comedy.
Sure, okay.
This is what I think stand-up should be. Like, when Jacqueline was working this out in L.A., there were a couple of times when I was on a show and then she was doing this afterwards, and I was just like, I'm going to stay. I'm going to spend an hour and a half just seeing what this is. I got to watch jokes come in and out, and it was really interesting seeing this live show that I enjoyed so much be turned into a special, because there is a way that a comedy special is always not real stand-up. Uh-huh. But this is, to me, a essay built out of one-liners. And I loved it.
Okay. If you're waiting for the big, like, fiery disagreement, you're not going to get it, listeners. Sorry. I love this, too. But, I really pick up on what Badatri, you're talking about. I mean, this is very funny and smart, and the parts that weren't funny were smart. And
of
the
course.
Parts...
Yeah. I'm not saying, oh, I didn't even, like, burst into a chuckle. Of course I
No, of course not.
But I don't think that is what the show is about.
Exactly. That's what I want to get at here.
Yeah.
I was struck also by her persona, approach, delivery, whatever you want to say. And at first, yes, you notice, you can't help but notice that this does not have the familiar energy of stand-up that... the kind that engages the audience directly, mm-hmm. the symbiotic relationship of the comic feeds the audience and also feeds off the audience. And look, I don't miss it. If you just go by TikTok right now,
yep.
you might be laboring under the impression that stand-up is just crowd work. And I'm going to Glensplain to Guy Branum here, but like stand-up is mostly thoughts and phrases that have been shaped into language over the course of many, many nights. And she is not waiting on the audience. She is not gauging their reaction. She's barreling mm-hmm. through. And she is expressing this stuff in such a theoretical, abstract, the word she uses is artistic way. The New York Times called it a stand-up that leans into theater. But, I mean, she's doing that intentionally, right? You don't do a J. Alfred Prufrock riff without knowing what you're doing.
You know, I had the boyfriend laid out on a bed like a patient etherized upon a table. His body a slow-moving fog, I guess. I've got him...
That is why the lit grad in me is like jumping up and down right now.
That's exactly, I could hear your fist pumping all the way from here.
Yeah. And I just wanted to throw in, like, this is a safe space with you three. I didn't catch the J. Alfred Prufrock reference, you know, and the special still really worked for me. Mm-hmm. So if you're someone at home and you just aren't as sharp on your T.S. Eliot as everybody, you know, I just want you to know this is still for you.
Of course.
The yes. boldness of not being scared to do stuff like that. Like, if there is something about this that makes it not for everybody or not the greatest, it is that some of these punchlines aren't for everybody. Mm-hmm. But they're for me, and it makes me so happy. And also there's a way that, you know, yes, she is theatrical in that she is not, like, having that back and forth with the audience. But in that, there is so frequently a lot of empty space. That is where comedians rest up. Like, you can do stuff that isn't as hard. And mm-hmm. this is an hour and a half of hard. Like, this is, to me, like, as a stand-up watching it, I was just in awe of the physical stamina and resiliency.
Yep.
The reason that most people don't do it is because they can't easily sculpt phrases like that. You know? Mm-hmm. They've got four per show. And, you know, mm-hmm. Jacqueline's got hundreds.
The joke writing calls as much attention as the jokes.
Yep.
The form is just as fun to think about as the function. Yep. Right?
And also, like, the blending of high and low.
Right.
Like, to me, this is a grand meditation about gender, bodies, and narrative and perspective, agency.
Oh, absolutely.
It is a big argument about what the mythology of sexuality has done to women and receptive sexual partners for all of time. But it gets into the dirt and it gets dirty. Like, I really love this one hamburger joke that she has.
To me, a vulva may be beautiful in the way a burger is beautiful. A burger with all its particular fixings, you know, wrapped up in crinkly, greasy, foiled paper. And then they cut it. I love when they wrap it up and then they cut it.
Oh, my God. Let's just say that joke holds.
Yep. But that's the bit, right? We are talking about stuff that is so bodied, literally bodied, carnal, visceral, mm-hmm. and stuff that in any comedic setting you're only used to hearing about with, like, those short, percussive, ugly Anglo-Saxon verbs, and we're talking about them in a way that is so lyrical, metaphorical, intellectual. That's mm-hmm. tension. That's the disconnect. And that's what's driving this entire show. That's what's keeping her going.
Right. And that also seems to be sort of like what's a driving factor for her mm-hmm. as a person, right? Is she's talking about, like, her reluctance to be embodied.
Right.
Right? Which yes. is something that, like, I related to, like, so, so deeply. And basically, like, the entire show is kind of engaging with that theme, embodying. Because it is the disembodied, hyper-intellectual perspective being forced to be brought to like the earthiest of acts.
Yeah. And I remember, she was performing in Philadelphia last summer. And I remember editing an interview with her. This is, of course, before the special when she took her off-Broadway show on the road. Mm-hmm. And she says, I actually don't think oral sex is funny. I just think I'm funny. And I think she's written the synopsis for her show herself with that one line.
Yeah. The more I got into this, the more I just surrendered to it, because this is what happens whenever you see someone who is clearly in absolute control of their gifts, right? The precision is the point. But that kind of kicked me out of the realm of stand-up into the realm of monologuist, right? Into Spalding Gray and Eve Ensler and Mike Daisy and Mike Birbiglia, who, don't get it twisted, he has his delivery can seem kind of loose and shaggy, but once you take a step back and look at the structure of a Birbiglia show, it's nested Russian dolls all the way down. But that raises the question for me, maybe not for everyone, but for me certainly, does it matter what we call this? Stand-up monologue? One-woman show, God help us?
It matters to me, and I think that this show is a searing defense of stand-up. The first time I ever saw Jacqueline, she was on stage at like a little bar in a basement on the Lower East Side, and she was walking around in a circle like that. And Europeans who were there to see the music act afterwards showed up and were not paying attention, and John Early tried to quiet them down. And Jacqueline popped up and said, no, no, John, my job is as a stand-up comedian, if nothing else, to hold attention. And I realized that she was, while using tools that are very different, was still playing within the world of what I understand. And I think that this show, to me, is a beautiful response to Nanette from Hannah Gadsby. Like, Hannah Gadsby is arguing stand-up cannot hold my experience in a way that is sensitive to me because it must have a victim. And this show is about the triumph of perspective, that even when there is something in your mouth that removes your power to narrate your own experience, that Jacqueline's perspective is strong enough to take control of all of these myths and all of these people around her.
Yeah.
And it's funny.
The problem is that in those moments, when I'm doing it badly, I won't be able to articulate to the person that I know that I'm doing it badly. My mouth is stuffed full of genitals. Do you see? Do you see the blowjob precludes your ability to narrate?
It is built of jokes. Like, this is a defense of stand-up.
Yeah. I was a viewer who was coming into this waiting for the Nanette moment, the rug pull, right? Because we are dealing with sex, and we're dealing with sex in such a playful intellectual way as to almost render it safe and comic. But there is a mention of a sex act and a moment that she refers to as what some might call peer pressure that is just fraught, incredibly fraught. And I kept waiting for that to come back in a darker way. Spoiler alert, it does not. But is that, do you understand that impulse, that conception of what she's doing?
I definitely understand what you're talking about, Glenn, because I think it's so rare that we spend time meditating on the like ways sex is complicated for women, right? Without meditating on the ways that sex is violent for women. Like, I just think that we don't actually spend that much time talking about women's sexual experiences when we're not talking about sexual violence. And, you know, it makes sense. You know, sexual violence is a part of a lot of people's lives. But it was incredible to see this space where we're playing in the sort of middle range of processing sex and female identity rather than playing at either extreme.
And they got me out to the car and they chanted, blow him, blow him, blow him, blow him. Maybe it sounds like peer pressure to some. I didn't experience it as such. No, I experienced their pressure as support, you see, because I was a young Tony Robbins reader. So I knew that if you tell people your goals, you become more likely to achieve them. You feel accountable.
To Margaret's point, I also think the writing concerns consent in a way that, like, sex is enjoyable. Sex can also be violent. But the point is, and I think a lot of times, and of course she talks about it, like Glenn said, like, you know, of course it may be it's a consent that is manufactured through peer pressure or just societal expectations of women as sexual beings. But at the end of the day, and this is, I mean, again, like, she doesn't have that big, glorious ending, but she says, it still remains very sex positive. She's like, I'm not saying you should stop doing this. But, you know, it's that idea. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I should just go ahead and call it agency. But there is a lot of agency which she is holding in this power.
I think that's exactly the word for it.
Even in an act where she's probably not at an age where you do it well or it's not good. It's not bad. But the thing is, it's something she's doing it. And it's something she is doing when she wants to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of power in that.
And she sets that up really well by that first 40 minutes is her prize fighting with mythology. It is her taking down and making penises less powerful. Like, when she describes the penis as being fundamentally floral, like, in a very, very verbal show, the moments that she decides to do physical comedy are so fun. But I think that this ambiguity that you guys are pointing to, that it does not simply go in one of the two directions that we are allowed, does set up the stage for what I think is her big ending, which is her invocation of teeth, her talking about the complexities that make a purity of experience, like, not diminished, but increased. Mm-hmm. I really think she is not being scared to be complex. And that's so fun.
I think that that is really something that can be speaking to specifically the example you brought up, Glenn, of being sort of brought to this party to perform a sex act.
Yep.
And when she says, I experienced that as support, like, I really believed her.
Yeah.
I believe that she experienced that as support then and experiences it as support now. And it's like, we live in a coercive sexual culture, right? Yep. Like, we're still in the process of undoing that. And yet, still, within that coercive sexual culture, we have experiences that, like, we get to define, that we get to understand, that can be normal, that can be supportive, that can be painful. And, like, I loved the way that she was articulating. Like, she speaks to also, she has a little bit on want, right? Where it's like, oh, if I wanted this, like, why was I hesitating? I've never hesitated over a French fry.
I've never hovered over a French fry.
Hovered is the word. Again, precise language.
She does this incredible job of then articulating what the want is. So the want isn't the simple want one has to eat a French fry, right? But the want is real and legitimate and it belongs to her. And I found that really powerful. Like, I loved that element of this special.
I mean, the last few minutes is like a very verbose and passionate defense of what one might call her style. And I find that fascinating. I said, you know, I spent all these years trying to do this thing, learn this thing. Now you got it. Like, you know, now I do it a certain way and I'm going to defend it. It's my style now. And I think that, you know, again, that question of consent, owning it, if you will, I think that's beautiful.
Just 2 points to style. I thought her choice of outfit was really surprising and cool. Like, everybody puts on a little dress or, like, a leather suit.
Yes.
And she is in jeans and a gray t-shirt the way that she performs this in real life. But I did think, I didn't love the way that this was directed. She stalked around a stage, and I frequently felt for the first 20 minutes like the spotlight couldn't follow her.
Exactly.
She makes a joke about not wanting to be Gossamer, but if she were a ghost, she would want at least 70% opacity. And there are these sort of, like, dynasty lights in the background. And I didn't love that. I thought that there might be a way of doing it better, but, like, by 20 minutes in, I wasn't thinking about the visuals. I was thinking about the performance.
That is so well said.
Yeah. Let's talk about the physicality, because I was grateful that she did not have the Madonna mic, the Steve Jobs head mic, whatever your frame of reference is. She needs an actual microphone because, given the subject, it functions as a prop. In some cases, it functions as kind of a stand-in. The thing I kept getting distracted by was that cord. That cord is so thick. She looked like a stevedore hauling something out of a cargo hold. Now, she clearly wanted that bit of business, and it never looked awkward per se, but it always looked like something. Like, was that part of, like, the Broadway, the off-Broadway show?
Like, I never saw her off-Broadway. I only saw her in spaces where she wasn't amplified.
Oh, okay.
But I do think, as somebody who has definitely thrown a mic cord as though it were a cape, I definitely understand. Like, and I think to me, it is, like, again, rooting herself in stand-up. And, like, a wireless mic, even a wireless mic is in its way a step away from what old school stand-up is.
Yeah.
I was surprised she didn't move a mic stand out of the way.
Yeah. I mean, it's, again, it's that embodying the tension, right? Of she's doing something radical. She's doing something that's pushing the form forward, but she's keeping herself anchored to that form in sort of visible ways that she really makes her own. Like, she throws that quarter around with such a land.
Absolutely.
There is always this temptation to distance yourself from that which is embarrassing and you know is trash. And stand-up at its best should be able to acknowledge the presence of those things in your world and also the ridiculousness of them. And, like, at no point here do I feel like Jacqueline is being false to feel cool. She is boldly honest through all of this artifice, and it really makes me happy.
Boldly honest with the artifice. I think that's a great place to end. Tell us what you think about Jacqueline Novak's Get on Your Knees. Find us at Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. Up next, what is making us happy this week?
This message comes from NPR sponsor HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. On The Sympathizer podcast, host Philip Nguyen joins the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen to discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Noom. Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, helps you build new habits for a healthier lifestyle. Check out The Noom Kitchen for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mattress Firm. To feel energized this spring, you need quality sleep. To achieve quality sleep, you need the right mattress. Mattress Firm will help you find the right bed to improve your sleep with their wide selection of quality mattresses at every price. Plus, if you see a lower price, Mattress Firm will match it. The right mattress matters, and Mattress Firm will find yours during the Friends and Family Sale. Shop in-store or online at mattressfirm.com. Restrictions apply.
What does it mean to be Black in America? In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as the Black experience, you'll hear it means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.
Now it is time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What is making us happy this week? Margaret, what's making you happy this week?
Glenn, this is a very embarrassing thing to say, but what's making me happy this week is my job.
We don't hear that often.
Oh, hey.
I know.
Say it again.
Repeat it.
I've just gotten to announce my next class for Not Sorry, and it is going to be a combination reading and writing class where we're examining Sense and Sensibility, but we're letting me investigate my feeling that, like, that book, like, there are just like a couple things I just want to tweak in there. So we're going to be doing that with the fan fiction practice of a fix-it-fix. So we'll be reading through and then playing with the various different things that we get to change in it. And that's all great. And then the thing that brings it up another level is it means I get to incorporate one of the greatest books of all time, which is Emma Thompson's filming diary for the 1995 adaptation of Sense and Sensibility. She starred in and wrote. And that is an incredibly delightful text. And so it's just like I'm marinating in all of these things I care about. And I'm sorry, my job is making me happy.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Margaret. But Dhatri, what is making you happy this week?
What is making me happy this week is a documentary called Time Bomb Y2K. The directors of the film are Brian Becker and Marley McDonald. It's a completely, absolutely archival documentary that documents the frenzy around the Y2K bug. Y2K was my first idea of what a catastrophe could look like. And I've always been very sad at the lack of representation of that fear, of that, like, frenzy around it. And, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, nothing happened. It was nothing. It was just, like, millennials doing their own thing of overreacting. But it wasn't, you know. It was a very big deal. And I loved this documentary because it treats it as a big deal. You know, there's a lot of archival material, news clippings from around the world that just talk about this thing that was going to happen that we thought would be the end of the world as we know it. Anyone who is my age and older and younger, for your general knowledge and education, please watch this documentary that is Time Bomb Y2K on HBO.
Thank you very much, Badatri. Sounds great. Guy, what is making you happy this week?
Glenn, there is a parlor game that improvisers like to play. Some call it Mafia, some call it Werewolf. But the basic idea is you're trying to figure out who's lying. All I want out of television is for beloved celebrities to play parlor games. And there is a show called Traitors on Peacock.
Yes, there is.
And it is the way that 11-year-old boys fight about who would win in a fight, Hawkman or Iron Man. You get to see your most beloved reality show liars. Uh-huh. And it is beautiful to watch, like realizing that a bachelor has to be able to lie and cheat as much as a Big Brother contestant. Amazing. Ooh. At all times, Alan Cumming, the host, is dressed as, is essentially performing the Deborah Carr character from Casino Royale, doing the broadest of Scottish drag in performance and activity. It is a magical show.
It's a magical show, Guy. You're absolutely right. And the second season is so much better than the first because we don't care about real people. We don't want real people playing this game.
We want Parvati to play the game.
We want housewives to play this game who understand that housewives is a game. This show is a game.
Brandy Glanville was so good the first season. I was just like, yes!
So, again, that is The Traitors, a wonderful show on Peacock. Thank you, Guy Branum. What's making me happy this week? Have any of y'all in your travels across the vasty web, your internetual peregrination, stumbled across the Instagram account of one Mr. Richard E. Grant?
Oh, no.
I don't think I have.
For folks, he's a British actor. He's technically a Swazi English actor, if you're keeping count at home. Long and storied career, this guy. Played most notably, if not villains, then what the Brits call cads and bounders, you know? His most famous roles kind of make you think, like, when you need to cast a human sneer, you go with my guy, R.E.G. Uh-huh.
Yeah, he was in Saltburn. Sorry, yes, I am Googling on the side. Yes.
His Instagram account is a kind of startling, pervasive wholesomeness. It is wholesomeness distilled to its essence. He just greets the world with open-hearted wonder at everything, like whether he's just sharing with you his feelings of delight and expectation because he's about to meet his daughter at Heathrow Airport, or he's walking back to his hotel. He's in Austria and he's kind of aglow because he's just taken in Puccini's Manon Lescaut at Klagenfurt.
Oh my God. I want this content in my life.
The one I've gone back to most often is the simplest one, and it's just his wonderfully crinkly, character-filled face, staring down the barrel of his phone, as he often does. It's a little like zooming your mom, because it's sometimes a little close. The phone's a little close. He's outside on a city street, and there's flurries in the air around him, and he just says simply, "Vienna, snowing at Christmas time." And I could watch that all day. That is Richard E. Grant's Instagram. That is what's making me happy, nay, ecstatic, this week. And if you want links for what we recommended, plus some more recommendations, sign up for our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. That brings us to the end of our show. But Dhatri D. Chaudhry, Guy Branum, Margaret H. Willison, thank you so much to all for being here.
Thank you for having us, Glenn.
Thanks for having us.
This was the funnest episode.
This very fun episode was produced by Liz Metzger and edited by Mike Katzeff. Our supervising producer is Jessica Reedy, and Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we'll see you all next week.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch. Support for NPR and the following message come from IXL Online. Is your child asking questions on their homework you don't feel equipped to answer? IXL Learning uses advanced algorithms to give the right help to each kid, no matter the age or personality. One subscription gets you everything. One site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And NPR listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/NPR.
What does it mean to be Black in America? And NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of stories as varied, nuanced, and dynamic as Black experiences. You'll hear. It means everything. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.